Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. I would expect that most people, when they think about horses, to the extent they think of them at all, think of them as being a feature of the rural environment and of country life. But it is a fact that in 19th century urban America, horses were very common. They moved freight, they transported passengers, they even fought fires. In fact, in large 19th century cities, there was an average of roughly one horse for every 20 people. At one time, for example, there were 130,000 horses working in Manhattan. That was in the year 1900. Chicago at that time had 74,000 horses, and Philadelphia had 51,000. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the horse in the city. That's the title of a book, as well as the focus of our conversation. And we have as our guests two historians, Clay McShane and Joel Tarr, both of them interested in the city life and technology. Clay McShane teaches history at Northeastern University, that's in Boston, and Joel Tarr is professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University, that's in Pittsburgh. And together they have authored this book. The subtitle is Living Machines in the 19th Century, and the book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. As we talk, certainly questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief so that we can keep things moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. That's the number if you'd like to call in. Also, there is a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call and you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, actually, even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Professor McShane, hello.
Yes.
And Professor Tarr, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, I should say.
Thanks to both of you for talking with us. I think it is a very interesting book and is full of a lot of interesting stories and detail. And I appreciate you giving us some of your time. The what I think is interesting, it seems to be the case that you feel that people generally, and perhaps even historians, have ignored the importance of the horse in the modern industrial world. And maybe I'll start with Professor McShane and ask, and then I could go to your colleague and ask why it is you think perhaps that the importance of the horse in the city has been overlooked, perhaps even by historians who are interested in city life.
Well, it is like, well, military history is probably a good analogy. Winners write history. And the automobile won and the horse lost. And so there's been a whole lot of writing about the automobile or about the trolley car or about the bicycle or other purely mechanical devices to the exclusion of these large natural beings that were central to urban life. You know, a kid in Chicago was more likely to see a horse daily than a kid in rural Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And I think here, Professor Tarr, and I think that you both make it very clear in the book that you believe that without horses and the work that they performed, that people simply could not have built or lived in these big cities that emerged in the 19th century.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the city operations as they existed throughout the 19th century depended very heavily on horses for a variety of different functions, not only pulling and hauling, but also stationary power and so on. I'd like to just go back to your previous question, if I might, however, and that is my own interest in the horse in the city came up very early in 1970 when I was actually working on the impact of transportation technologies on the city, and almost accidentally in the sources I was using ran across all the issues that related to horses that I hadn't really thought about. And so I began thinking about how one might discuss the horse relationship to the city, and to discuss it as not only a problem, but also as something that would made the city possible to made it possible for the city to operate. I think for quite a while, however, a lot of historians, when they looked at the horse and its role in the city, thought about it primarily in terms of as a problem, as inefficient, as a producer of manure, of urine, of something that and you had to get rid of if you're going to modernize a city. And we clearly feel that's the wrong focus.
Yeah. Something that I certainly thought was very interesting that I would not have really, I think, been aware of before was the importance of horses in making urban mass transit possible. And certainly, I guess I would have realized that, yes, there probably were people, certainly wealthy people in cities that rode them and had carriages, and there were taxi cabs, essentially, that were drawn by horse, but didn't really realize that what, in effect, would be that the version of the bus at that time was something that was at first a large, kind of like a stagecoach in a sense, that was pulled by horses. And then later you get to the point where you have your first streetcars, things that run on rails. But in the beginning, those were also pulled by horses.
Well, it's kind of interesting. One of the things that drew my attention to this was in the neighborhood where I grew up in New York, there was a large storage area where the transit authority stored its buses, and the drivers referred to that structure as the barn, which is kind of interesting. The usage has persisted even though the horses have been gone at that date for nearly a century. So that that's where the origins are, and the determination of routes in terms of avoiding steep grades, how frequently there are stops, were often still determined in the age of horsepower. In fact, it's striking that we determine the strength of transportation machinery by the term horsepower.
If I might
chime in here also,
we shouldn't forget, of course, that the steam railroad running on tracks preceded the coming of the horse car. So in a sense, it's a logical kind of step to move from rail transportation between cities to the step of having rail transportation within cities. But however, the power source for the steam railroad, the steam locomotive, was unacceptable in many ways in, on city streets, which were heavily used by people for a number of different kinds of functions, as well as just passageways. And so there's really the search for an alternative kind of mode of technology that could be used to pull cars on rails in cities. And this is where the horse comes in. And, of course, the omnibus, as you mentioned, as the non-rail bus, horse-drawn bus, preceded the streetcar. But in the and you do have this competition that we talk about between omnibus drivers and owners and those that want to launch streetcars that really, by the 1850s and the 1860s, the omnibus's influence has been greatly reduced within cities, and more you have these horse-drawn passenger cars on rails within cities, hauling people around in terms of what you call mass transit, and more people began to use them for different urban functions.
Yeah, and just to take that one step further, I think it's interesting to think about how the presence of horses and the work that they did changed city life in many ways. And here there is one example that it's really interesting to think about the fact that the presence of urban mass transit in the form of the streetcar was one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that it made it easier for a person to live in one part of the city and work in another, and helped encourage the the physical separation and the fact that that got further and further between the two places, the place where you worked and the place where you lived.
Yeah, you're essentially talking about suburbanization, of course, the separation of work and residence. I think for quite a while, historians wrote about, sort of dismissed the horse car as an important fact in suburbanization because of its relatively slower speed compared to the electrical streetcar that followed it, or even the cable car. But it's clear that the horse car did provide for the opportunity for a suburban out-movement by a class of the population that had the means to afford the fares and the time also to take these vehicles. So the so-called two-part city, the very heavily urbanized city and the suburban part, really, while it developed even before this, is accelerated. That movement is accelerated by the coming of the streetcar, but only for those who could afford it. It is not something that working class people essentially use as a means to separate work and residence. They continue to walk to work.
What did it cost to ride the horse car at the turn of the last century?
Typically a nickel, with some variation for transfers, et cetera. Went up a little bit during the Civil War because of inflation, but essentially a nickel.
A nickel. So, and at that time, for a lot of people, that would have been a significant amount of money, enough so that they either, that would have meant that some people simply couldn't have afforded to pay the 5 cents to ride.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if workers were making a dollar a day or even under that, they're going to spend 10% of their income on transit. Don't forget also that these streetcar lines that had to have municipal franchises in order to run, and in many cases fares were set within the franchise terminology that's used to grant the right to the streetcars to use the streets. And certain rights and responsibilities were clarified in those statutes.
Our guests in this part of Focus 580 are two historians, and they're both interested in the history of the urban environment and in urban technological systems, Joel Tarr and Clay McShane. Joel Tarr teaches at Carnegie Mellon University, and Clay McShane teaches at Northeastern, and they are together authors of a very interesting book, which is titled The Horse in the City: Living Machines in the 19th Century. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press and talks about all of the things that horses did in cities and the fact that horses were a very important source of labor in cities and that they did all kinds of things. They hauled a lot of freight. They pulled fire engines. They pulled streetcars. They certainly make the argument in the book that without horses and the labor that they performed, that the big cities of the 19th century, places like Chicago, for example, or Philadelphia or New York City, just wouldn't have been possible. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation, and certainly people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And first of all, we'll talk with somebody in Hoopston. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Uh-huh. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. Just a couple of quick comments, and I'll go ahead and ring off. Recently had an opportunity to take my two young children to Chicago inside a working firehouse, and they had pictures on the walls way back when it was teamed by horses. And it was quite a mechanized technique that they had, very quickly bringing the horses into the barn or stable and dropping the gear on them and hooking up the fire trucks, fire engines, whatever, and hitting the road. Is quite elaborate, very quickly done. But my comment, or what maybe your guests want to comment on, is perhaps the public health issues that the horses posed. Recently saw a program, I think it was on the History Channel, and particularly this time of year, the carnage on the street, the number of horses passing away because of the heat or whatever, posed a real threat, and I think some of the cities actually had set up separate departments just to handle the disposing of these dead animals. And I was wondering if your guests had any comments on that. I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Yes, certainly that was a big issue.
I've looked at the New York City public health records on this. There was a firm in New York that had a contract to pick up dead horses and guaranteed pickup within half an hour. And I believe they did that. And the reason for that is a dead horse is worth a lot in terms of its byproducts, especially the skin, which is used for very high quality leather. But once rigor mortis sets in, the leather is useless. So at least in New York, and certainly in other very large cities, horses were picked up quite rapidly. Now, that may be less true in smaller cities, and as the size of urban herds declined, I think that system tended to fall apart. You sometimes see photos of dead horses in the street, but I think those were taken at a time after the big horse processing plants had gone out of business because there just weren't enough dead horses to make a profit, so that the dead horses don't seem to be that big an issue, at least in major cities, because they did all kinds of things with it. You can make dog food, the skin, obviously, the hooves can be boiled for glue, the blood and bones are used for fertilizer in the... In the final emergency during the siege in 1870 in Paris, residents of the city actually ate the street railway company's horses. Now, I suppose it's nice to have a power system you can eat in a time of emergency. It's certainly something we don't have now.
Yeah. There's one other point here, too. That is that the system that Clay was describing, which worked pretty efficiently because it was driven by the value of the horse, really broke down also at times of epizootiacs, that is, where horses, horse flus, great horse flus, like the great epizootiac of the early 1870s, where many cities really were desperate because so many of the horses were either ill or died, and so those that pulled fire engines, for instance, but performed all these other functions were not available to do that function, and the problem of disposing of the carcasses of dead horses was very, very, very great.
All right, let's talk with someone else, and our next caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Just two comments. I think I read, when you're talking about fire departments, I think in the early days that the fire departments used to compete. So when they got on the scene, if they arrived at both about the same time, they would actually end up in fights and forget about the fire. So I don't know what period of time that was. But I remember years ago that I was, it was a tour on the west side of Chicago, and it seems to me that, you know, we're going through mansions and they actually had places for horses. So I guess my question is how many, you know, is there any numbers or any estimates of how many people of wealth actually had their own horses?
Not many. They were very, very expensive to keep. So it was much more common, except for the extremely wealthy, to maybe rent a small carriage for a Sunday afternoon drive or a sleigh in the winter. If you look around urban neighborhoods that were built in the 19th century, you will see very few with carriage houses or stables in the backyard. In Beacon Hill, which was then the most affluent neighborhood in Boston, stables were actually banned. And people boarded their stables on a nearby commercial street. And they would go over or send a servant over to get their horse and carriage in the morning. But the ultra-rich, of course, owned them, and the afternoon promenade through, say, Grant Park in Chicago or Central Park in New York was an important part of ostentatious showing off of wealth for the very, very rich. But that did not permeate very far down the social order. The costs were just much too high.
I was quite impressed when I saw it. I was taken back. I couldn't believe it, actually. But anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the subtitle and the idea that people, in rather than valuing horses as living beings, which we the way we might like to think today, that they thought of them as living machines. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they would be ill-treated. In fact, because they would be very valuable, you might actually think, well, that wouldn't be very smart, especially if your livelihood depended on the animal. But you know, having said all that, what word do you think that the particular consequences of thinking of horses as living machines? And I don't know who would not. Maybe Professor Tarr, why don't you take a shot at that, and then Professor McShane, you could.
Yeah, well, I think that, first of all, the idea of the horse as a machine, it comes up very early, and you can find it in 18th century writings and so on. And when the people that own horses as work instruments or instruments from which they derive power, for instance, in breweries or work instruments pulling, you know, vehicles, we had to calculate from an input-output kind of perspective what it costs to maintain the horse, what it costs to stable them, you know, and how the work efficiency of the horse changed over time. And during the 19th century, there's a more and more measurement, attempt to measure the efficiency of the horse, the pulling power of the horse, the amount of calories the horse required, the amount of food intake it required. And then when the steam engine, of course, came along, there are competitions that are held between steam engines on the one hand and horses on the other hand to see which one was the most efficient in terms of its pulling power and its the intake, a financial intake it took to maintain them, you know, as sources of power. So that all throughout the literature, you know, about horses, there is this attitude, and particularly by the large horse organizations, by the way, the streetcar companies, for instance, and those that needed large amounts of horses, to think of it as a replaceable part in a larger system that they have, either to deliver goods or to deliver people or things like that, and to think of it also as dispensable. So the black beauty concept of the horse may have existed among a very small set of people, the affluent and the elite who promenaded as Clay pointed out, in Central Park and other parks. But for the most common uses of the horse, it was a very different kind of attitude.
Hmm. I think, too, it's maybe worth making the point in all of this, as you do in the book, that one thing you can say for urban horses is that apparently they got better care and they lived longer than their country cousins.
As far as we can tell, that's true, but the data on that is extremely imprecise.
Hmm.
All right, but as far as I can tell, that's true. You're better off getting fed on a regular basis in a stable than grazing, and American farmers often put their animals out to graze in the winter when there was snow on the ground, and, I mean, it's just a horrible way to treat them.
Let me make another point about the horse as a machine.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, there were many small owners of horses, too, who had drays, who did hauling throughout the city, and so on. Actually, we actually have a journal by the owner of a dray and talks about his horse and maintaining his horse. So it's possible that individual owners of horses, who still would be clearly working-class folks, had developed some kind of affection for their horse. My father, for instance, when he was growing up in New York City in the early 20th century, used to pull scrap stuff, materials out of buildings. He had a horse called Shivers, and obviously he had some sense of affection for this particular horse. And I think that is possible. And yet, of course, the owner of a horse, the individual owner, would still have to look at it from the cost-benefit perspective. Ed, you know, could they afford to keep up this animal as it decreased in its ability to do the necessary work?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller. We have someone here in over in Bloomington, Illinois, on our line one right here. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Uh-huh. On the benefit side, I don't know if you covered this, but my understanding is that horses were used at the turn of the century as pharmacies, that they actually were resources and produced vaccine. I believe they were largely responsible for eradicating certain diseases like, I think, typhus, perhaps others, and they were even retired to splendor, the ones in New York City apparently, to Poughkeepsie, New York, in some recognition of their contribution to humanity by helping to produce these vaccines. I wonder if you'd comment on that or if you found anything else on that.
Well, the example that I'm familiar with is diphtheria.
Is it diphtheria? Yes, yeah.
In New York. They are still used to some extent for that purpose. Estrogen, which is still, of course, a commonly used medication, is synthesized from the urine of pregnant mares. And there's a farm, I guess, somewhere in Ontario who, I guess, keeps mares constantly pregnant so that they can produce the right substance.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. And again, other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I don't know, Professor Tarr, was there anything you wanted to add on to that?
Well, only that I very recently in the New York Times, I saw an article about horses and horse serums and so on. Unfortunately, I can't remember the date or the exact content of the article, but the theme was about, or perhaps it wasn't in the Times, maybe in Scientific American, about the uses of horses as producers of necessary pharmaceutical products.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm curious about, we've talked about how important horses and their labor were in big cities. I would expect, because there were, for example, in a place like New York, the number that you have in the book is that somebody has estimated that in 1900 there were 130,000 horses in New York. Well, if you have that many horses, what you need a lot of food for them. You need water. You need stabling. You maybe need some vet care. And then the horses to do their work, you need all the stuff that goes with them: wagons, carriages, harness, shoes. If you think about it that way and ask the question, how many people were employed in some kind of horse-related job, that is, all the kind of infrastructure that would be necessary to support the horses in doing what they did, is it possible to answer a question like that?
Oh, it's very possible. I mean, it's clear if you look at the industrial census, which lists numbers of people that fall into specific kinds of occupations or tasks, the thousands and thousands of those who relate to the care of the horse, hostlers, for instance, or blacksmiths. We went over in the book, we talk about how many enterprises are related to the horse were in a specific city, how many the carriage industry was very ubiquitous. Every city required blacksmiths, but there were also big factories producing things like horse blankets, for instance, employing thousands of workers, some saddles and other things. There was a very famous, and there still are, of course, some stores that retailed various kinds of things required by the horse, not only horseshoes or saddles, but also the proper riding uniform to use, many different types of whips, and so on along like that. We didn't try to calculate what percentage of the economy of the U.S., for instance, was dependent upon the horse. But if you think about the automobile as an analogy, we know that the automobile is very so critical to the American economy today in so many different ways, and the horse played a very, very similar kind of role.
Mm. Let's take another caller in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is in regards to what would happen to people that were allergic to horses and how they went about their lives. Were they socially isolated or?
I haven't run into a single incident of that. It's a good question. I have no idea why I haven't run into it.
Okay.
It appears nowhere on any records that I've looked at.
Huh. Okay.
Because, well, you were saying, caller, that you're allergic to horses, huh?
Yeah, and sometimes I like to think, what would happen to me if I lived maybe 200 years ago? Would I just have to stay home and not do anything?
Let's not forget that a lot of people that are allergic to cats. I'm allergic to cats, but I've never seen a mention, you know, in the earlier period, the 19th century, for instance, of those kinds of allergies being of concern. Now, people worried about miasmas during the 19th century as being provoking illnesses of various kinds, and miasmas that came from decaying organic matter, you know, and maybe sometimes there was confusion between allergy reactions to horses and something to the effect of the decaying organic matter, particularly the manure might have on people. So it might have a crossover there.
I see. Well, great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Now, I'm wondering, Joel, about someone like Emily Dickinson, who seldom, if ever, left her home and lived in that tiny town in Western Mass, but had an extensive correspondence with well-known literary figures in Boston. If there wasn't, may have been something in the air that kept her from going to the big city and kept her up in the mountains.
Yep. Could have been there.
All right.
So don't forget again, the horse, sorry, talk about allergies, but the horse manure bred flies by the many, many, many millions. There's again another kind of concern that rests upon a health basis or even an annoyance, a nuisance basis.
All right. Well, again, let's continue. We'll talk with next someone in Sycamore. This is line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. Your comments about horses as machines prompted me to wonder about a truism, or at least a saying that I've heard since I was very young, about what they did with horses once they no longer were able to carry their own weight, literally, I guess, or be useful. And I always heard they were sent to the glue factory. Is that really true?
Yeah, I think we talked about that a little earlier, a dead horse was actually, or once a horse either was dead or had come to the end of its useful life as a horse, was very valuable for some variety of products, the things that you could make out of the horse. And I think earlier also, for example, one of the guests talked about I think it was in New York City, there was a company that what they did was they picked up dead horses. And they could do that because the horse had value. Eventually, it got to the point where that wasn't valuable. But I don't know, again, maybe one or the other of you can talk a little bit more about the, you know, what do you do with a horse when a horse is no longer good for doing work?
Well, we spoke about the leather. The hair, the mane, and the tail can be used to stuff furniture and as a stiffener for plaster. The bones and blood, the blood is dried and used for fertilizer. The bones are ground up for the same purpose, and you can, from various other parts of the horse, make glue and carbon black, and I know there are other byproducts as well, so that you could, a dead horse was a valuable commodity that could be sold. In fact, there were lawsuits in cases where horses died on the city street about whether the city owned the horse or the person who owned the horse while it was alive owned it, or if someone found an unattended dead horse, if they could claim the rights to it, because it was such a, all those byproducts were so valuable.
There's also the live horse itself, let's say, that it basically is not as functional or useful in the capacity that had been used. What happened to those? Well, they might be downgraded and sold off and put to other kinds of uses, inferior uses. Blind horses are sometimes used on horse whims or in mines, or they might be, and Clay can probably comment on this, but the extent to which large organizations might have put horses that they retired out to rural areas in some kind of way, or out to farms.
There were a few large eastern firms that had what they called retirement farms for their horses, but those were very unusual. But most urban horses had, like Black Beauty, a life course where you might start off hauling a street railway car, then hauling a wagon, then hauling a cab, so that you would kind of work your way down the ladder as you became older and weaker and perhaps slimmer and lamer.
Well, what I'm taking away from all this is that if the horse was used in a glue factory, it was a very minor part of its usefulness.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we continue. The next caller here is in Danville, and line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to make a couple of comments. First of all, horses aren't grazed in the wintertime anywhere. I mean, that's what hay barns are all about. You know, you put up hay during the summer with the horses, of course, and then would feed them out through the winter. Farmers, you know, that was a very critical piece of equipment for them. The horse was just invaluable and was one of the reasons why we were able to basically change the landscape in such a short period of time, was because of their power. And as far as picking up dead horses, up until the 70s here in central Illinois, you could still call a number and they would come pick up a dead horse for you. They were still valuable even then. But the one thing I'd like for you to comment on, and I'll take it offline, is I know that Hines, the ketchup founder, one of the things that he did besides just being completely revolutionary with human employment is he really took good care of his horses. He had stables that were centrally heated, cooled with fans in the summertime. But one of the things that he did was a corporate symbol. All of his horses were just jet black, you know, a very specific size, et cetera. And I wondered how many companies did that. And I'll listen offline.
All right.
Well, let me talk about Hines because he's a Pittsburgh firm. We have some pictures in our book of a prize-winning Hines team, for instance, and of a Hines stable. I have other pictures that did not make their way into the book, though, of Hines stables, and also of the very the equipment that was available for horses. Horse foot baths, for instance, within the Hines plant, and so on. Unfortunately, a lot of the early records of the Hines company in regard to their horses were destroyed in a great flood here in 1907. But there was, as you point out, this pride in horses. Many, many cities would have these horse parades each year in which they would parade their horses and different kinds of vehicles. And again, reflecting the pride that organizations and firms, and certainly the breweries would also be, there'd be two of the breweries too, took in their particular fleets of horses and the care that they took of them. Now, that would be not necessarily be true, though, of course, of smaller firms and smaller users in terms of this pride and care.
All right. Well,
I would like to comment on the agricultural situation.
Sure.
For a moment.
Sure.
The way we take care of horses today is not the same as the way they were taken care of a century ago. And there is reason to believe that rural America was overhorsed, but farmers tended to have more horses that they could use. For example, the military drafted over 1 million horses during the Civil War, and it just didn't have that much impact on farm production, which suggests that there were a huge number of surplus horses out there. There's a whole lot of literature, once again, from the 19th century, from rural reformers of one kind or another, or people touring the countryside about how poorly farm animals are treated. So I think the scene is considerably different from what it is today. Now, It may be especially different in your region of Illinois, which was horse breeding country, where I suspect they took better care of their animals because they wanted to grow healthy animals they could sell. But it, in general, I think the picture was a lot different than what we see today.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, as you note in the book, that apparently the state of Illinois was the leading breeder of heavy horses in this time that we're talking about. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guests are Clay McShane. He's an historian at Northeastern University. That's in Boston. Joel Tarr teaches history at Carnegie Mellon. That's in Pittsburgh. Together, they are the authors of a very interesting book, The Horse in the City, about the importance of horses in big cities in the 19th century. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. On to someone here on cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was born in 1897 in Chicago, and the stories that I've heard about her is that she and, there were five brothers and sisters, their mother was left a widow at a very young age, and the business that their mother ran that supported the family just barely was that she ran a livery stable, and that had always sounded so interesting to me, but I never really knew anything about it. And I know that they lived upstairs of the livery stable. I wonder if you would have any ideas, information about what that life might have been like.
Well, livery stables are really interesting because, first of all, they were extensive in cities, many livery stables. And basically, they allow sort of like car rental agencies. They were horse rental agencies, but they also performed different functions in some cities. One of the interesting things I found about Pittsburgh, didn't seem to be true of any of the other cities we looked at, was that livery stables doubled as undertaking parlors. And we have pictures in our book of a livery stable and a sign over it. I'm also advertising them in terms of funerals and hearses in front of them. So, horses could be rented out at a livery stable for a number of different kinds of uses. I would think that living over a livery stable would be somewhat difficult in terms of both the odors and the noise that you might get. You get complaints, for instance, of people that lived next to stables or near livery stables about the noise, the smells, and so on that would come from these stables. And there were attempts to confine them to certain areas of the city. And so, therefore, in many cases, well, I did say the livery stables were kind of all over the place. They tended to be clustered, though, in many cases, too, clustered in one part of the city rather than another. And they also varied in size and relatively small stables. And we have some information about the economic success of some of these stables in our book. And then the very large stables that really were, basically house and rent out hundreds and hundreds of horses.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it would have been a hard life for this young mother with her five little babies.
I would think it would have been.
Yeah.
It was also a highly seasonal business because most of the demand was in the summer or in snowy weather for sleighs. And so if you look at the business records of those firms, the owners are all struggling financially in the spring when the preceding season's profits have been eaten up or close to eaten up. And it's almost like a resort business today. You have a string of weekends with bad weather in the spring, no one will rent your horses, and you're in financial trouble. So it's a very insecure way to earn a living. Those stables often also boarded horses for people who owned them, and that was much more secure.
Yeah. Well, I thank you. You've given me more insight into my family's heritage there.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll get one more at least here. This is someone in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Isn't the treatment of horses the basis of the SPCA? Isn't that what it came out of?
That was a question I was hoping that we'd get to. And I think, the answer to that question, I think, is yes. Isn't that right?
I'll hang up.
All right. I don't know which one of you.
Clay went through the records, actually. So.
Okay, yes. The ASPCA was founded in New York City by a guy named Henry Berg, who was concerned with the mistreatment of horses in that city. It's kind of interesting because it's part of a group of generically anti-violence groups in the 19th century. The people who were involved in it had been abolitionists, had been concerned with eliminating flogging in prisons. The same people who founded the ASPCA founded 10 years later the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, and later on other groups against domestic violence, so that there's a kind of general attack on violence. But horses are the primary concern. Analogous example, the modern veterinary profession has its origins in taking care of urban horses.
Let me just go on with that.
Sure.
And in Pittsburgh, what happens with the organization that's founded as a local type of ASPCA moves into the area of cruelty to children. So that's out with cruelty to animals and horses, and moves into the area of cruelty to children. So some of the same people, in many cases women and elite women who are involved in these activities, moved over into different aspects of social life that they found reprehensible in the urban context.
Hmm. Something else I think is interesting, and we're just down to a couple of minutes here, so we don't have a lot more time, but that is the connection between horses and people who worked with them and the beginnings of organized labor. You explained the fact that horses, certainly we used to haul freight, and at first there were two-wheeled carts with one horse, and then you got four-wheeled carts with two horses, and the people who drove those carts were called teamsters. And that, in fact, that the Teamsters, the modern Teamsters Union, dates to Chicago before 1900. And it's interesting to think about, again, here, the involvement of horses and horse people in unions.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. This Teamsters Union seal still has a horse on it,
mm-hmm.
I believe. And I might note, reflecting back on an earlier question, if you read Teamster Union periodicals, they take a very strong, consistent anti-cruelty stance. And they also are remarkably sentimental about their horses. They print the equivalent of foldouts of especially handsome horses. They write poetry about them. They name horses with often very flattering names. We'll name them after millionaires or British kings, or in one case, there's a teamster who named his horse Winham after the horses that were smarter than people in Gulliver's Travels.
Hmm.
So that they're important. Taxi drivers are unionized early. Express company drivers, although that's with the Teamsters, street railway drivers are unionized early at a time when they're mostly driving horses. So, yes, it's very important in the formation of the union movement. And they often include provisions in the negotiations for better treatment of the horses.
And just real quick, I think anybody who's ever had a horse or dealt with a horse, one thing they know is they produce an awful lot of manure. All those horses, I imagine all those 130,000 horses in New York, place in New York City, how did they deal with that?
Well, the manure, of course, in the beginning is viewed as a resource. It's a great fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have farmers from the farm areas, local farm areas, just outside the city coming in and to capture, you know, to haul the manure, to get it from, they had, some of them had arrangements with livery stables to purchase the manure, to clean the streets of the manure. You also had the same thing with human waste, of course, in the 1880s even, where the human waste were used to fertilize farms on the fringe of the city. But the horse manure was particularly valuable. What happens over time, though, is that it becomes viewed more and more as a nuisance rather than as a valuable commodity. A nuisance is because it's ground up by traffic and because it breeds flies and it creates odors in the city. And there are a number of very important conflicts, nuisance suits, some of which we talk about in the book, between residences and stables and the seasoning of manure piles. You have great big piles of manure where the manure was piled up to season before it would be taken out of the city to be used. So it's an interesting concept or example of how something that's seen as a valuable resource to be used to produce some valuable crops becomes more and more of a nuisance and seen as a health hazard as well as a productive of smells and you know, crossing streets, to help people cross streets, women particularly with the long dresses, so they could stay out of the manure path and so on.
Well, we're going to have to stop. There's a lot of very interesting material here in the book. So for people who are interested in reading more on the subject, look for the book The Horse in the City, Living Machines in the 19th Century. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press by our guests, Clay McShane, professor of history at Northeastern University in Boston. Professor McShane, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
And Joel Tarr, professor of history at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Professor Tarr, thank you.
Thank you.